Well, good evening and welcome to the latest in the occasional series of Directors' Dialogues. And we are pleased that on this occasion, and it's the first in the Directors' Dialogues, that we have an alumna with us in the form of Clara Furze, who's also less important than being an alumna of the LSE, also Chief Executive of the other LSE, which rather tiresomely these days tends to use LSE as its acronym. We've thought of suing, but we fear that their resources might be rather greater than ours, so we'll probably rub along. But it was the case that when I was sitting with the FSA and my appointment here was announced, one regulatory colleague from overseas rang up straight away and said, "What's happened to Clara Furze?" And I said, and I was so baffled by this question, because that was his first question. And I said, "Well, I have no idea. She seems to be doing perfectly all right to me." And he said, "Well, she must be going if you're going to be the head of the LSE." So I said, "Ah, different other LSE." But we are delighted to have her back, apparently for the first time since graduating. As you all know, she's CEO of the LSE now. Before then, immediately before then, ran the Crédit Lyonnais derivatives business in London, Crédit Lyonnais Rouse, which was one part of Crédit Lyonnais that didn't go bust, and was also deputy chairman of Life, but worked for a number of city firms before then, including UBS. And I think we ought to begin, Clara, well actually before I ask you your first question, I ought to explain for those who haven't been to one of these dialogues before that I reserve the right to ask questions for about the first half, and then I open it out to others. So far we've had absolutely no shortage of questions, but if we do, I shall pick on someone right in the front row to think of one if you don't. But first of all, let me begin by asking just a little bit about your time at the LSE. Why did you come here?
Well, I was quite determined that I did want to come here, and my recollection is that I was at a boarding school in the UK, in West Malvern. This was at a point when my parents were living in Denmark, having been through the American system in a couple of countries, and they decided that Britain was the place that we should go. And I was at this really rather dull boarding school, feeling very much like a fish out of water, because obviously I was not British, and I'd grown up all over the place. And I read something about the LSE, and the thing that that appealed to me enormously was the fact that here was a university that was at least half of the population, I think, at that time, came from overseas. And that made a strong impression on me. I'd also decided at that age, I was about 15, that I wanted to read economics. I'm not quite sure why. I think it's because I was reasonably good at maths, and so there seemed to be a bit of a link there, and this idea fixed itself in my mind. And I do think it was certainly one of the best decisions that I made.
And where did you go immediately after here?
I went straight into the city, which again was something that I had decided that I wanted to do. And the decision that I made when I went into the city was that I would become a commodity broker rather than a stockbroker. And that had a lot to do with what I'd studied here. One of the subjects that I'd studied was the economic history of Latin America. And I was very interested in the whole development of the commodities business in South America, in Latin America, and the extent to which it helped the development of those countries. So I sort of linked that with commodity broking. And off I went to sell cocoa and coffee and sugar.
Well, I can use that as a commercial for tomorrow afternoon's lecture by the central bank governor of Argentina, who is very much, his whole existence is bolstered by the soy price at the moment, so it's the only reason that Argentina's kept afloat. But let's fast forward to the stock exchange, because the chief executive seat at the stock exchange has been, for some years now, not so much a hot seat as an ejector seat, because I think your three predecessors, from memory, have all failed, didn't all? Have all left, as you say, in less than ideal circumstances, let's put it that way. Peter Rawlins, on the back of the failure of the exchange to develop a clearing system. Then Michael Lawrence, who I guess didn't get on terribly well with his constituency, and he left before the end of his term. And then Gavin Casey, your immediate predecessor, in rather unfortunate circumstances surrounding the failure to sell the rationale for the IX deal. And many people would have said that, you know, after three disasters, this was one job that it would be a very good idea to steer clear of. And no doubt people advised you that at the time. So why did you think that you could succeed where your three predecessors have failed?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's fair to say that my immediate predecessor failed, because what he did was put the stock exchange into very good business shape. Of course, the proposed merger between the London Stock Exchange and Deutsche Börse did fail, IX did fail, and that was the reason that he left. And I have to say, I was surprised when I had the call from the headhunter. But what I did was, I did what everybody does intuitively these days, which is I went onto the website. I got a lot of information from the website. And I was actually enormously impressed by what I read about the exchange. And what became obvious to me was that the gap between perception and reality was so enormous. In other words, there was a perception, particularly in the press, but I think also amongst the authorities, that there was a lot of the exchange that was amiss. And clearly, the business, as it was presented in the accounts, and from what I could see on the website, was actually a spectacularly good business. So I looked at the numbers and I thought, this is an impressive business. I looked at the share price, and it was very clear that the share price significantly undervalued the business, which seemed to confirm my view that, you know, that there was something here that could be improved. So, you know, that was obviously interesting. I then met a number of people. I spoke to a number of people. One of them was you, Howard. And it was quite interesting to get a feel for what people thought of the exchange. We called it The Exchange those days instead of LSE. I thought LSE was better than The Exchange, since there are a number of exchanges. And I began to warm to the idea. And actually, if you look at the history of the exchange and the role that it's played in the City of London, and the enormous success of the city itself, and, you know, the global nature of the business it's conducted, it just seemed like an extremely exciting opportunity. And at the same time, of course, the exchange was going through a process. It had to mutualize, and it was going to become a public company, and that was pretty clear. The question was when that would happen, and we decided it would happen sort of pretty soon after I arrived, and we became a public listed company about 6 months after I arrived. So that obviously created an opportunity for me to move the business away from what was a mutual structure to a commercial business structure. And dealing with that change, I think, has been enormously helpful to the business, having a commercial focus. Mutuals do have very specific challenges to deal with. And there's no question in my mind that a number of, you know, the difficulties that the exchange had in the previous 10 years had a lot to do with the mutual structure on which the exchange was previously based.
But this is quite controversial, though we've got used to it in London. In New York, you know, they're still breaking themselves apart by arguing about this, and indeed in many other countries about demutualization. I mean, why? And the argument against demutualizing is that this is essentially a service function to the marketplace, out of which there's no particular need to make any profit, that it should therefore be, it's rational for it to be owned by its members because it's a platform on which its members perform, if you like. And why is that wrong, and why is a corporate structure appropriate for this kind of, what you might say, is a utility?
Well, mainly because that kind of mutual type structure, that utility type approach to life, allows conflicts to flourish and tends to create an environment which is very inefficient. And, you know, if you look at the other major exchanges in the world, and particularly at the U.S. exchanges, it's really quite interesting. You look at their top line and you look at their bottom line, and the distance between the two is absolutely enormous. So, you know, what I'm saying is they appear to look relatively inefficient, and that's certainly the way that, you know, that the exchange was. I mean, long before I arrived, because as I said before, Gavin Casey, my predecessor, did a very good job in you know, creating a sound business base for the business. But you know, it's really quite an interesting exercise. I mean, we are by far the most efficient equity markets business in the world. If you look at our costs, and you know, you look at our top line, you look at the profitability per capita, on virtually any measure you look at, we are relatively efficient. And it's partly because we were in the vanguard of this demutualization and listing process. And of course, we started from a pretty good place as well. But mutual structures, I mean, I also sat on the board of Life, as you said earlier, Harry, and that, you know, the futures exchange also had a mutual structure, and that didn't work. I mean, you know, conflict of interest flourished on that particular board. And, it meant that an exchange that, for the first 15 years of its life, had been tremendously successful and had very strong growth, you know, hit a very bad patch.
Because one of the reasons in New York for the huge difference between the top line and the bottom line was in chief executive salary, of course, which is, took quite a big piece out of that. But your advice to John Payne in New York would be to demutualize.
I would have thought that he must be thinking about that. You know, he also comes out of the commercial world, you know, commercial environment, and that's a natural thing to do. It creates commercial disciplines. It also means that you can raise money in the capital market, so you're much more flexible. You have strategic flexibility, which is almost impossible to achieve if you're a mutual. But I think that, you know, the biggest benefit is the impact that it has on the culture of the people working within the business. They suddenly see it as a business. You know, when I got there, people within what I call the business, I'm sorry if I use that word so often, but it's part of the change I tried to create it. You know, within the organization, always refer to it as the exchange. Now people talk about the business. I mean, that's quite an important distinction.
Another, we talk about the structure of what, if you like, what is an exchange these days, because particularly in overseas, actually, much maybe less so here at the moment, there is a very lively debate, as you must be aware, wherever you go, about just what function should be in this box called an exchange. I mean, obviously, there is a trading platform, and no one particularly disagrees with that, although there are people outside who'd like to, you know, bargain that rent away. But in many other countries, there is a lively debate, not only about the structure, which we've talked about, but about the role of the exchange in regulation, for example. Mm-hmm. Now, here, roughly coincident with your arrival, or maybe slightly before it, I guess, the government had decided to take the listing function, which was one of the key regulatory functions of the exchange, and put that over into the FSA, leaving the exchange with a relatively modest role, though not an insignificant one, still in frontline market regulation. In other countries, you know, there are exchange heads, including an alumnus of the LSE in Hong Kong, for example, Charles Lee, who will die in the ditch for that, and says that it's absolutely crucial to an exchange's role and status to have that function as part of the exchange. Are you happy not to have it, or would you like it back?
No, we are very happy not to have it, because, you know, we don't want to be in a position where there is any potential for conflict of interest in what we do. I mean, that's, you know, that's what we got away from when we moved away from being a mutual to a commercial organization. And I think if we were the lead regulator, then clearly there would be a potential for conflict there. That's certainly the way that we see it. I mean, you can't have, you know, responsibility for admitting, you know, companies to the market if, you know, what you're driven by is the profit motive. So there has to be, at the very least, that Four Eyes principle that says that, you know, that there are checks, appropriate checks and balances in place, and that seems to suggest quite clearly to me that you have a regulator that is quite separate from the business. I also think that, you know, for a global financial services centre like London, which has such an extensive international business and had so many regulators, it was very obvious that the concept behind FSA was right, to create a single regulator that could deliver a much more efficient regulatory structure for the city going forward. So certainly that makes a great deal of sense.
So how far does that logic go? I mean, because there are some who say that actually even the frontline markets monitoring that you do now might be better elsewhere. I mean, how do you see that argument?
I don't think, well, that's secondary markets regulation, and I don't think anyone else can do it as effectively as we can do it. And in order to do it, obviously, we're a recognized body. So, you know, we have to meet certain recognition criteria. And in order to do that, we need to regulate the secondary markets business that goes on the exchange. And I just don't see that anyone else could perform that as efficiently and, you know, with the sort of knowledge that we have about the market. But again, you know, there are checks and balances there, because obviously everything that we do, you know, is communicated to FSA if it needs to be.
Mm. Now, so that's the regulation. I mean, you've got the platform, which I say is uncontroversial, and that's the regulation side, if you've talked about. Then what about clearing and settlement? I mean, you may argue, I think, that in a way it's somewhat accidental that the London Stock Exchange doesn't have its own clearing system. I mean, it was trying to invent one, and it was one of those nightmare IT projects which went wrong, and then the government asked the Bank of England to step in to design one, which turned into Crest, which, you know, became a separate entity. And similarly, LCH was the clearinghouse. You sit on the board of LCH still?
Yes,
yeah.
I do. Yeah.
Now, in Europe, of course, there are huge arguments about the extent to which this should be the case. And some other European stock exchanges, notably the German, are organised where you have a platform and you have clearing and you have settlement all in one organisation. And in the jargon, this is goes in. People can be divided into two camps: the verticalists and the horizontalists. And this is a little bit of a sort of little end or big end of dispute about, you know, which end you open the boiled egg. But are you a firm horizontalist? And if so, how far does that go in Europe?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and it's it is actually quite complex, in that if you look at highly developed equity markets like the US markets and like our market, what you see is horizontal structures in place. So you have the kind of structure that we have in the UK, which is that you have a separation between trading and clearing and settlement. If you look at less developed equity markets, like the ones in Germany, where they tend to, or historically they've tended to invest in fixed income rather than equity, you see what we call the vertical silo structure, which is a structure which has the whole of the transaction process controlled by the exchange. Now, that in itself wouldn't be a big issue, because the argument that Deutsche Börse put forward, or one of the arguments that they put forward in defending their vertical silo structure, is to say that the only way in which they can make the whole of the transaction process more efficient, more cost efficient, is to control every single piece of it. Okay, and since they are bringing something together which is less developed than our equity market here, okay, you can understand that argument quite easily. The problem is that what we are supposed to be doing in Europe, as you know, is developing a single market. And you cannot have a viable single market in Europe if you have barriers to competition. So the problem that we have with vertical silos is that they are anti-competitive. In other words, if any of you want to buy a German stock, you have to clear and settle that stock, that German stock, through the Deutsche Börse systems. The cost of doing that is significantly higher than it needs to be. What we want to do is introduce competition into the European marketplace to make that European marketplace more efficient. We believe we're in a very strong position to do that because obviously we have a highly developed market that is already very efficient. In other words, commercially it makes sense for us. It makes a great deal of sense for the development of this European marketplace. And anything that stands in the way of that, obviously we see as a bad thing. So this argument, I think, has been more or less accepted now. In fact, DG Competition in Brussels has recently put out a paper on clearing and settlement, which suggests that they also believe that there should be open access between clearing and settlement systems in Europe. So the argument is going our way. And I don't know how long it will take, because things that happen in Brussels seem to take quite a long time, but we will end up with a significantly more efficient European capital market if clearing and settlement barriers come down. And that's important because it means that companies raising capital in European stock markets, and that's what we're there for, so that companies can raise capital cost effectively, okay, we'll be able to do so at a lower cost of capital. So that's what we're about. We're about trying to deliver the lowest cost of capital to companies that are building their businesses.
So you think that it will be the Commission who break this apart? I mean, at one point, Don Cruickshank, when he was chairman, appeared to be threatening to take Deutsche Börse to court or something himself. But you're waiting for the Commission to act, are you?
Well, what Don did, I thought, was make the case very clearly for why it was that this subject, which seems, I think, is actually quite complex, is so important. And he did that. He did that sufficiently well that, you know, that DG Competition have now produced a paper which, you know, validates strongly pretty much everything that we said. So we're very happy with the outcome.
And they will, that you expect them to take it forward?
Well, that's what they say they're going to do. They say they want to see full and open access between clearing and settlement systems in Europe, which is a pretty fundamental change to the way in which things happen today. And what it does is it validates the market model that we have in London, which happens to be pretty successful, so that makes sense.
Now, on the other let's pursue the other dimension of the European strategy. And I think most people looking at your tenure at the stock exchange would have no difficulty in accepting that, in terms of the reputation of the exchange, it's quite different and much more solidly based than it was when you took over, which may you very fairly say, you know, Gavin Casey was doing some good things, but they weren't perhaps perceived because of the issues about the IX deal. But one point that could be made is that the strategic conundrum which the IX deal was one attempt to resolve remains exactly as it was then, in that it's still not clear how the trading platforms, if of a single financial market in Europe, will evolve. Now, one thing we know is that, I don't know how many equity markets are in the EU at the moment, but probably 35 or something like that, and compared to maybe 2.5 in the US.
Yeah.
It doesn't take a genius to say that in the fullness of time, if there is genuinely a single market, there won't be 35 different equity market platforms. If you look at what people are doing about it, well, you can see there was a sort of tortoise and hare, if you like, in the sense of the IX was an attempt for a big bang solution, and Euronext, led by the French, has been more of the tortoise of just sort of semi-merging things, putting things together in a group, seeing kind of what happens. But the tortoise doesn't seem to be doing too badly just at the moment. And since the IX failure, for those who've forgotten that particular acronym, this was the attempt to merge the London and Frankfurt stock exchanges into one. You know, the London Stock Exchange has not made another strategic move in Europe. When are you going to?
We made a number of strategic moves, but what we haven't done is proposed a consolidation move. So this is the big topic that seems to be everyone's favorite topic. And yeah, it's pretty obvious why. The reason is that, as Howard has said, there are around 30 exchanges in Europe, and in a single market in Europe, that doesn't seem to make much sense, absolutely. within those 30, there are three very big players, us, Deutsche Börse, and Euronext. And obviously, we tried to do a merger with Deutsche Börse about 4 years ago, and that failed. It actually failed for very good reasons. And what has happened since then is that the reasons for the failure of that have been diminished, if not removed. So there has been very significant progress in Europe. And although the progress is difficult to see because it's not a Big Bang type event, what you've seen in the last 3 to 4 years has been a strengthening of the market model that we've built in London. I'll give you one example of that. Last year, we did 85% of all Western European listings. Okay, so our position in the European market, in the European equity market, has strengthened enormously in the last few years. And this has been in really quite difficult markets. You know, we've had the most difficult market since 1974. Equity markets have not performed well, as you know. There's very little question, I think, in people's minds today as to whether, if there is a consolidation, whether that should take place anywhere but London. Okay, so one of the big issues around the IEX merger was a concern about the fact that some of the business would be regulated out of Frankfurt. It is now generally accepted that the kind of regulation, equity markets regulation, that we have in London is good for markets. It's it's principles based, obviously, rather than rules based, which is the big distinction with the US regulatory culture. It's based on caveat emptor rather than caveat vendor, okay, which is good because that promotes innovation, which is what the City of London is very good at. And there's a general acceptance that, you know, what we have in London is a very strong market model. So that is a big step forward. And, you know, 4 years ago, you were looking at both Paris and Frankfurt saying they wanted to be the financial centers of Europe, of this bigger Europe, and certainly of the Eurozone. That hasn't happened. If anything, more business has gravitated towards the City of London. We've also had a couple of very important directives coming out of Brussels, and the most recent one, the Investment Services Directive, has pretty much validated the market model that we have in London. So in other words, the way in which we do business. That, again, is enormously important. And all of that needs to be the case if there's going to be any kind of consolidatory move with another exchange that does business differently. Because clearly, what we have in London is a tremendous success story. I'll give you another statistic. Something like, I think the last number I saw was 46% of all international equities business takes place in London. Okay? London has by far the biggest international fund management community of any city in the world. About 35% of all the money that is invested out of London is invested in overseas equities. Okay, if you look at the US, that figure is less than 10%. So we have an unusually international market in London, and on any measure, a fantastically successful market. You know, we are 35% of the Euro top 300 by value. If you look at the Euronext markets, which is four European markets, including Holland and Belgium and obviously France, they've got about 22%. Okay, the German market is about 10%, and the Swiss market is 10%. So we have a formula, which we call the London Advantage, which is enormously successful. And, you know, obviously, if it is possible to do a deal with another exchange that validates what we have built in London, then we will do that. But consolidation is not an end in itself. It may be a means to an end.
But how is your attempt to, your cheeky attempt to steal the business from the Dutch?
Yeah, that's good fun, actually. I'm Dutch myself, so it not that that has anything to do with it. But that's very interesting, because what's happened is that that the Dutch market has had a change of what we call market model imposed on it through the Euronext integration. So Euronext is obviously the bringing together of the French equity market, the Dutch market, the Belgian market, and the Portuguese market. Okay, so this is one way of creating a consolidation in Europe, and I think you described it very well when you said it's a tortoise-like effort to do that. But the interesting thing is it isn't working, and it isn't working in Holland, and we've been invited into the Dutch market to provide them with another way of trading their equities. So we're going to start doing that at the end of May. I was in Holland about 10 days ago, and you know, there's a lot of enthusiasm for this. And you know, there's a number of reasons for this. The main one is they don't like the fact that a certain amount of change has been imposed on the way in which they do business through this integration. And if you actually look at the quality of their market, it has deteriorated in the last few years. So in other words, spreads, market spreads have widened. The value of trading has gone down. They say their costs have gone up. Our cost base is significantly lower to start with because, as I said earlier, we're by far the most efficient equity markets business in the world. So we have a very, relatively speaking, a very low cost base. That means that we can go into the Dutch market, we can offer pricing which is 40% lower than the pricing that they currently have. And that's obviously very attractive to them. And also, because they are a relatively well-developed equity markets culture, you know, they like the way in which we do business, and they welcome the opportunity to do it our way. So we'll see where it gets us, but you know, shifting liquidity from established markets is obviously quite a difficult thing to do. There's really only been, you know, one other example in the last 10 years. It's not an easy thing to do. But certainly the messages that we are getting from the Dutch market and also from the market in London, because 40 to 50% of all the business going into the Dutch market is generated in London, actually comes out of London, is that they will support it. So we'll see.
Well, there's a lot of liquidity in Royal Dutch Shell, if not a lot of excitement in terms of the price. So let me throw things open at this point. Actually, just before I do, let me just ask one final question of my own while you're thinking, and that is during your time at the stock exchange so far, the one event that has been characterized as a failure was the Life deal, where the exchange was interested in acquiring Life, but it didn't, and it went to Euronext. How serious has that been for the exchange's strategy?
Well, obviously the derivatives markets continue to grow, and you know, this was one of the reasons that we wanted to do a deal with Life. But the Life business is mainly fixed income. In fact, something like 80% of their business takes place in 3-month euro money contracts. And what we wanted to do was not just create efficiencies through a merger, but to build their equity derivatives business with them, because they have an equity derivatives business that is relatively underdeveloped. And we thought if we merged with them, we could develop that together much more quickly. They chose to do a deal with Euronext, mainly because they wouldn't be integrated within the Euronext business. We wanted to do a full integration, and that didn't appeal to them. They wanted to continue as they were. So they haven't been able to derive any of the benefits that we foresaw in bringing together Euronext as an equity exchange and Life with its equity derivatives business, you know, creating a better market between them in that particular product. It's a shame that we couldn't do that with them, but what we have done subsequently is to go into a business with OM, the OM HEX now, which is the Swedish exchange, to get into, to build the UK equity derivatives business with them in London in a venture that we call EDX. And that is a relatively young venture. but what we hope to do with them is develop the strongly growing over-the-counter equity derivatives business through EDX. So we will achieve the same goal that we wanted to achieve 3 years ago, but in a different way.
Let me throw it open to the audience at this point. Yeah, if you could say who you are and... take the first one over here. Thank you.
Two questions, they're from different spectrums. One is the first one, I'll ask that one second. First one is, I don't understand the structure of Euronext. I've been living overseas for a while, so you'll have to clarify. In regard to your trying to obtain a business from Holland or Belgium, is it possible that the Dutch and Belgian stock exchanges can sort of decouple themselves from Euronext, or are they actually now owned by the London Stock Exchange, owned by a company, or is it owned by a company? In other words, is that another avenue rather than going down the route of going at the moment, which is trying to take away the trading?
Well, the Euronext structure, to answer your first question, is the bringing together of four markets. So the French market, the Dutch market, the Belgian market, and the Portuguese market. And they're all supposed to be on a single trading system, have the same kind of regulation. And the idea sounds quite nice, because actually if you are able to put it together efficiently, then you create lots of cross-trading, which should be quite good news. Okay, so your trader sitting in Amsterdam can easily access the other markets within Euronext relatively cheaply. Okay, so that's the theory behind it. In fact, it looks a bit like a loose federation of exchanges, because markets do business in different ways. And a lot has to do with the history and the culture of markets within that particular country. And as I said before, the Dutch market is a relatively well-developed equity market. And so they have a different approach to trading, more similar to our approach than the approach that's been, or the model that's been imposed through this Euronext integration. They are part of the Euronext group. The Dutch market is part of the Euronext group. But if the market chooses to trade on our system rather than the Euronext system, then what that effectively means is that they're choosing to do business away from the technology platform that Euronext provide.
Can the Dutch Stock Exchange, which is still so formal, can it actually decouple from Euronext, or is it now
No, no, it is part. It is part of Euronext, so they can't just decouple. Okay, it is part of the Euronext business, so that's not possible. But obviously, if all the business moves to another trading platform,
is there much ownership of Euronext in the Netherlands?
Because
it's a single.
I forget how it was actually put together, but yes, I mean there will be.
So there'd be some incentive in terms of ownership, but I mean it is one single capital structure. It isn't just a federation of exchanges where they could wake up one morning and say, let's do something else.
Yeah.
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 How kind.
Careful.
25, actually.
In other words, what you would say to somebody who's sort of, say, meeting you sort of socially is be aware of this thing and this thing and this thing.
What you mean by way of warning? By way of warning or by way of. What would I say? I would say that, the City of London is the most extraordinary place. I mean, it contributes 5.3% to GDP. It's fantastically international. I mean, I would have thought for anyone coming out of LAC, it's just a natural place to look because it's so international. And it's, it's sort of instinctively international. And you know, the London economy itself, of course, is fantastically successful. I think it's the same size as, you know, Switzerland's economy. So this is a, you know, a spectacular success story. I don't know how I actually sussed that out myself, but I don't think I did really. I think I sort of got there by accident. So I would say don't go there by accident, because it's a great place to be. Two other things.
Likening us to Switzerland is a forecast of the outcome of the EU referendum. Is that?
So you've got currency risk. Well, that's what the City of London is there to help with, I mean, LSE has such a fantastic reputation abroad.
Yeah.
As well, and it's worth taking the currency risk.
It's not yet euro. Okay.
I mean, it's a serious point though in relation to your business. I mean, how far is not being in the euro a drawback in terms of this European integration, and I mean, your dream of sort of getting other people to migrate onto a London-type platform? Is the euro an obstacle to that?
Well, you know, the truth is that it isn't, because London is the euro trading centre of the world. You know, we do most of the forex trading in euros. You know, the three-month money product, if you like, euro product, is traded, you know, partly in life and through the interbank system in London. Something like 40% of all the trades reported to the London Stock Exchange are done in euros. So it doesn't really matter. I mean, obviously it matters if you have currency risk, but that's what the city is there for.
Oh.
I mean, obviously if you're a student, it's a bit difficult to hedge your currency risk on fees, but I don't think London is the financial services centre for Europe. It is. And currency is just a factor. I'm sorry, I haven't answered your question. I feel terribly bad.
I'm mulling it over still. You can come back to it while you think about it. Yeah.
I'm Duncan Katz, and I can express an interest in that. I advise the SWX sort of stock exchange on various matters and create just to clear the air on that one. Clara, the thing that I'm observing, and probably seeing it for some of the things I'm up to, is that there's a danger, I think, for the big European exchanges and the smaller ones, that we all go after each other's business at marginal cost. You were saying you could do the Dutch business for 40% of their cost. I can do things you're doing for less than that, your cost. You can, you know, your next can come across and do at marginal cost, you know, the FTSE 100. Isn't there a danger that we're all racing to the bottom?
No. I mean, what we're doing is we've got two specific advantages. One is a technology advantage, which gives us a serious pricing advantage. In other words, the cost of the services we provide are significantly lower than the cost of similar services provided by any other exchange in Europe. Deutsche Börse, Euronext, and also SWX, as I think you know. So all we're doing is the sort of the normal commercial thing, which is to employ that advantage, that significant competitive advantage we have, to win more business. The other big advantage that we have is a customer advantage, which is that we're at the center of this, you know, fantastic global market for equities.
We know that the investment bank can't get the loyalty. I also work for them.
Yeah, and I did too. And I did too for 20 years. But, you know, the fact is that, you know, we are providing them with a much better service at a much lower price. And we can afford to do that because we're starting. Well, then they would have to provide prices that are 80% lower than their base prices in Paris, which I think might be quite tricky for them.
Not if they think they can retain their core income, which is what you think you're doing, and then be pricing on that basis.
No, I don't think that's right. And they're not providing the same kind of service that we're providing. So they cannot provide a better service at a lower price, which is what it's all about.
I see.
We will see.
When I went over here and then went over there.
For many years, the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ grew by promoting themselves internationally as a place to take either secondary or even primary listings for international companies. Now, in the last few last year or so, it's been this thing you might have heard of called Sarbanes Oxley, which has massively increased the regulatory burden, so much so that the international companies on the New York Stock Exchange and on NASDAQ are seriously saying, we don't want to be there.
Mm-hmm.
What opportunities does this present to London, the London Stock Exchange, to say to people, come and get your listing here, and how are you exploiting this?
It presents very significant opportunities, and we are exploiting them. You know, we spend a lot of time in Russia, India, and China in particular. I've been twice to China. In the last 6 months, my chairman was there, you know, the week before last week. My director of market services is going there the week after next. And, you know, it's clear to us that we have an offering in London which is very attractive to companies that want to raise capital from the international capital market, because we have a fund management community that is very international and very large and is professional. You know, that's a great attraction to them. I mean, obviously we have regulatory advantages as well, and Sarbanes-Oxley has made that very, very clear. But the major distinction is the fact that London is home to the world's international fund management businesses. And what that means is that, you know, a Russian company or Indian company or Chinese company looking to raise international capital is finding the right kind of investor through London. Okay, that's quite different from going to NASDAQ and having the US retail investor invest in your company. That obviously creates more volatility and so on. So London has certain very significant advantages, and now there is a relatively new one, which is that it's become very obvious that the regulatory environment that we have in the UK works, and works very well. And the contrast between Sarbanes-Oxley and the UK listing regime is not only, you know, very, very favorable for London, that contrast, but also certain independent companies have rated London as the best location for corporate governance standards. Now, obviously, that's key to companies who are seeking to raise capital. They have to demonstrate that they have good corporate governance standards. And, you know, one of these agencies, Deminor, for instance, has said that London has the best corporate governance standards of any market in the world. So all of those things help us enormously. And we're marketing very actively.
Just a follow-up. Apart from one Indian company, we don't get seen much in the
air. No, that's not right. We have 434 international companies from 58 countries listed on our market. And AIM, our market for growth companies, has internationalized, is internationalizing rapidly itself. So we've had a number of international listings on AIM.
Can we right over the cross side, thank you.
Okay.
Well, you actually haven't answered specifically on the China point.
Yeah. Well, we're just in the process of establishing an office in Hong Kong. So obviously, you know, as I said earlier, we're spending an awful lot of time in China. But it is a question of, you know, of selling the story. And of course, in the days that we were mutual, this wasn't something that, you know, that we really did. Now that we're a business and we have, you know, commercial objectives, it's something that we do, I think, much better. It's much better resourced. And I believe we will see you know, we will see some success in China. Certainly the message, the messages that we're sending are well understood and very well received. So, yeah, we're very focused on China.
Yeah.
When Howard was chairman of the RSA, he made a speech about the importance of international accounting standards. How important do you rate the development of the European notices for ISB regime as compared to US GAAP regime in the competition for the exchange where people want to calculate the international capital?
Yeah, I mean, we think it is very important, and you know, also we have a much more pragmatic approach to this kind of thing. For instance, you know, we accept Japanese GAAP. Okay, so we don't, you know, we have a principles-based approach rather than a rules-based approach. So we start from a perspective which is more pragmatic. Anything that makes access to capital easier and cheaper, you know, has got to be a good thing. So we, you know, we support IAS fully.
One at the back in orange.
Yes, I was interested in your analysis of the horizontal vertical issue, and I was quite interested to understand how I think they also noticing this back to growing merger between PNF and London Clearinghouse and the London Stock Exchange. And in a sense, you're sharing one of the most probably vital component of your service provision with your key competitor now. I can see ahead of a lot of conflicts of interest, potentially confusion there, especially with the pressure on transaction charges that are likely to go away. How would that be resolved in the horizontal structure?
Well, the interesting thing is that it looks like it has been resolved within LCH ClearNet, and one of the reasons that we were involved in quite intensive discussions around that in the second half of last year was in order to ensure that the structure that emerged within LCH ClearNet was exchange neutral and pro-competitive. And that is where we got to. So there shouldn't be any conflicts of interest within that structure. That's what we want to try and ensure. And what's so interesting is that, you know, the Dutch market will, we hope, you know, prove this very point. The fact that LCH and ClearNet have merged is the single most important factor in it in enabling us to compete in the Dutch market. That's good for the Dutch market. It's good for the development of the single market in Europe. It's good for us. It lowers costs generally. I mean, competition is an extremely good thing. So it isn't a question of managing conflicts of interest. It's a question of setting up a structure that is pro-competitive to start with. And that was what the discussion was about. And we got what we wanted.
But in a sense, you've got this mutual and a for-profit vying for the same revenue stream. I'm sort of wondering who will win out in the end.
Well, there's a compromise solution was agreed. You know, I'm on the board, so, you know, obviously it will be my job on that board, as well as the other directors, obviously, to ensure that what was agreed is delivered. You know, I won't say it was an easy deal to put together, but I think we got to the right place at the end of the day.
One more. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah.
Well, we haven't strictly speaking. Well, we haven't got self-regulation. What we have is we have FSA regulating us. We are a regulated body. We then regulate secondary markets trading. Although any problems associated with that are obviously communicated immediately to FSA for them to deal with. So it isn't self-regulated.
One more, and then I have one final question. Any more? Yes.
Clara, you're a very successful woman operating in
I don't think of it as a man's world. Maybe that's the answer. And actually, I don't think it is a man's world. I mean, I have to say, when I got on the tube 25 years ago and went into the city, I was the only girl on the tube reading the FT. But I liked that. And, you know, if you like that and you don't worry about being different and so on, then it's actually fun. And I think, you know, the city is very hard work, but it's such a fun place to work that if you do what you do well, then the gender thing just doesn't matter. It's never mattered to me, I have to tell you, never. I just like my job, and I like working with people, and I like building teams that deliver, and we have a lot of fun.
Well, you stole my last question. So that's fine, in which case I can allow one more. Or if not, yes.
Well, we obviously have our plans. I won't say any more than that.
Portugal, here we come.
Your words, not mine.
Clara, thank you very much. Very interesting. We're grateful to you for exposing yourself to this dialogue, both structured and unstructured. Grateful to you all for coming. There'll be more of these dialogues, watching the events leaflets. In the meantime, thank you very much. Good night.